Dylan, yep. Speaking of cowboy churches, I enjoyed first service where it looked like a bunch of calves looking at a new gate when they walked in this building, because you walk into a place you've been before and you kind of know your spot, right, Rob? And you walk in like, man, nobody has their spot. And so we encourage you to come up front, and people up here going, I'm never sitting in here again. This is a very intimate space. Ollie, where Oliver is, that's about 30 feet. He likes that spot. That's 30 feet away, further than the furthest seat in there was. So very different. And a year ago, we were sitting right where you guys are sitting. You remember? But it was outdoors, and people were honking at us, and it was hot. And we had one Sunday, because that was outside. I was kind of over against that wall, which is also outside. And one Sunday, we had church right after a wedding on a Saturday. I don't remember. Do you remember whose wedding it was? It was Aaron's wedding? Aaron. And they had confetti. Was anybody there on that epic day? And there was this confetti tornado that was going up, and it would go up and over the roof. And all the kids were, it was just, they were amazed. It was our version of special effects. So we'll be in here till about Thanksgiving-ish, part of the adventure. So last spring, we were like, there was like five of us in there, and you guys were in your house. And then last summer, we were out there, and then we were back in there, and now we're out here. We get to go back in there again. It's fun. Grateful for this space. If we didn't have this space, we'd have to go hunt for a gym or something to be in. So we're grateful. So Ted Williams was a decorated Korean War fighter pilot. Oh, and about these seats up front, we know these. What we found out, this is totally unrelated to the message, but it's interesting to me. So this front, wherever we put the front row is a throwaway row. And if we put it where Bruce is, people would sit behind Bruce. So we put a row right here, and I hope nobody ever sits here. It just would really freak me out. But we put it there knowing that you'll probably sit in the next row. So anyway, to what we're really here for. Ted Williams was a decorated Korean War fighter pilot, but he's mostly known as baseball's greatest hitter. And he got into World War II a little late, so he trained fighter pilots. And then when the war was over, he went back to baseball. But then he was called up from the reserve to active duty to Korea. He was very unhappy about it. He hired a lawyer to fight it. He even called on a young Senator John Kennedy to try to help him get out of going to war. But he lost his fight, and he was forced to go to Korea, and it embittered him the rest of his life. I saw an interview when he was an older man, and he was really upset. My point is not that he was wrong to feel like he'd already served or that he didn't want to go to war. Lots of people don't want to go to war. I don't blame him. But it was why he was angry that was so fascinating to me. His lifelong controlling passion was to hit baseballs. And the dream that drove him every day from the time he was a little boy on was that when he walked down the street, he wanted people to say, there goes baseball's greatest hitter. That was his controlling passion. And going to war cost him some statistics, and that's what made him furious. I saw an interview where he said, can you imagine what my stats would be if I hadn't gone to those blank wars? But even still, he achieved his dream. He became the best in the world at hitting a ball with a bat. And one year he did the baseball impossible. He hit the ball 4 out of every 10 times it was thrown to him. One biographer said after watching him at bat, and I heard this, I didn't read this, I heard this interview. He said, if I had met Jesus Christ himself, I couldn't have been more overwhelmed. It was like being in the presence of a deity. Man. But of course, like all human heroes, baseball deity or not, in due time, 2002, he died. And his body was frozen in a procedure called cryogenics, and it's where the corpse or just the head is frozen at extremely low temperatures, with the hope that in the future, science will be advanced enough to bring the person back to life. And his daughter said, I watched her interview, that being an atheist, their family was an atheist, Ted was an atheist, she said, we have no religion to provide comfort, so my dad placed his faith in science and the slight possibility of a future where he could be reunited with his family. He's dead. He accomplished his one controlling life ambition. He was good at hitting balls with a bat. But he was, by his own admission, a terrible father, a terrible husband. His daughter said he lived with a near constant undercurrent of rage. Most of the time, she said, his anger was over things he had absolutely no control over. So he was a baseball god, little g god, who could, in his best year, hit the ball 40% of the time, but he could not control the outcomes of his own life, and it infuriated him. So baseball has the statistics. You can keep score in a game pretty simply. Which team has the most runs? It's just numbers, usually single digits, like 3-1, which is why I find it so boring, but sorry, Grant. But in individual careers, the statistics can be quite complex. But it is those individual statistics that measures one player against another. And Ted's statistics evidently qualify him as the head hitting god in the baseball pantheon. But he was, really, let's think about this. He was a grown man playing in a costume. That's what a uniform is. It's a costume. With toys, that's what a ball and a bat is, on a playground, that's a field. And I'm being sarcastic, but it's factually accurate. He was an entertainer, and that's a legitimate profession and a terrible obsession. And being impressed with one's own statistics, comparing my stats with another's, trying to be greater in this or that, it's childish and something that's insane for an adult to do. But there are plenty of ways that we measure our life against others. Money, accolades, degrees, Bible knowledge, career progression, Facebook likes, looks, family accomplishments, you name it, we measure it. And if we can measure it, we can compare one to another. And as I was reading and watching the story of Ted's life, I could say, and I did say, you accomplished your dream, and so what? But then as I turned it off, I thought, but what is my life dream, really? What is it? Not what do I say it is, what's it supposed to be, but what is my life dream as revealed by the values that shape my choices. We're in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 today, and Paul is going to pull out his stat sheet in this chapter and compare it to some other people's stat sheets. But he's not a Ted Williams. He admits that in doing this, he said, I'm engaging in sheer folly. And in this admission of this being fool's talk, he's highlighting folly, not embracing it. He's going to use sarcasm or irony as a teaching device to help the church see more clearly what to believe, value, and do. So in chapter 11, verses 1 to 6, he indicates why he's giving his stats. He's concerned that they might still be susceptible to being led astray again from sincere devotion to Christ, the Christ preached in the gospel, by those who seem to be more impressive than Paul. They'd been led astray before, they'd come back, and he was worried that they may get their heads turned again. So Paul's been defending his own apostleship, not so people would say, there goes the world's greatest apostle. That was not his goal. And that would be utter nonsense to him. He defends his credentials in the letters because he wants them to place their confidence in the truth of the gospel. So here's his line of thinking. I am a credible, reliable messenger with an incredible, reliable message. But he's afraid their minds could be misled yet again into believing something other than the gospel by what he sarcastically called the super apostles. And these super apostles paraded their stats to improve their status, but their lives and their message were far from the truth. And so Paul talks about the danger of the Corinthian thoughts being led astray by these thought bandits. In chapter 10, he wrote of taking thoughts captive and making them obey Christ, meaning measuring thoughts that come in our heads that we allow to nest there by the truth of the gospel. And if a thought tries to take root that's out of line with the truth, then we must compel that thought to surrender to the truth. I call it IDing your ideas, like a sentry, a guard at a military installation, checking IDs. Do you belong here? Do you have legal authority to be here? And as thoughts come, we have to ID those ideas to see if they belong, because it matters a lot what you believe. There's a great little book that was recently released this summer. In fact, called Before You Lose Your Faith, Deconstructing Doubt in the Church. And the book addresses a phenomenon called deconstruction, which is applied in different areas, but they define it as dissecting and often rejecting the faith you grew up with, often all the way from Christianity all the way to atheism. And the authors, in a number of pointed essays, essentially challenge people who are deconstructing their faith to doubt their doubt, to deconstruct their doubt. Apply the same level of scrutiny to your new faith that you did to your old one, because all beliefs, including atheism, are a faith system. And the book reveals that people are often not really rejecting beliefs that they just now are thinking, oh, now I'm thinking for the first time. Before, I've just sort of blindly followed my parents or my church, whatever, because they're just now opening their eyes, beginning to think for themselves. But often, they demonstrate, these authors, that they're rejecting beliefs that never were fully true. They weren't really what the Bible teaches, or they weren't fully thought through or personalized. Because every person has a worldview, and a worldview is, first of all, a set of truth claims. And reality is what it is, and only one set of truth claims is, in fact, true. And Paul, without hesitation, says, gives his life for the gospel of Jesus Christ as the very truth of God. But since we're not just biological computers holding data, we're persons with heart and passions and lives, these beliefs shape the values that shape the behaviors that become a life. And so in 7 to 15, it's a little odd if you read this chapter, you think, why is he making a big deal here at this point about not taking any financial support from the Corinthians? Well, it had to be addressed for several reasons. Those reasons are a part of comparing his credentials to those of the super apostles. Among the Greeks, it was regarded as degrading for a philosopher or a teacher to engage in manual labor to supply his needs. As a matter of fact, if you were a philosopher, if you're a teacher, and you had to work with your hands, then you weren't really credible. And so Paul shows up in Corinth, and he's working with his hands, doing his trade as a tent maker, and they're going, wait a minute, the super apostles, they're not doing manual labor. Paul is Paul legit? So he asked in verse 7, was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel to you free of charge? He didn't think that manual labor was lowering himself. He's using sarcasm to make his point. He did take financial support from the churches in northern Greece and Macedonia, but not from the Corinthians. In fact, he said, I robbed other churches, verse 8, speaking again sarcastically, by receiving support from them to serve you. So he's answering two questions. If you read this and you go, why is it here? He's answering two questions. First, does Paul care about us? Two, can he be trusted? Is he a legitimate teacher? And he assures him in verse 11, God knows I love you. Well, then why don't you take our help? Because you're too immature for me to take your money. I'm separating myself from these masqueraders, these pretenders, these super apostles. I'm not an apostle for hire. So he could take money from the Macedonians, but not from Corinth. And so now Paul's about ready to read his career stats. And he's going to give us his induction speech into the Apostle Hall of Fame, the greatest of all time. So he's going to show us what for the Corinthians would have been totally confusing. We look at it and go, yeah, that's amazing. But the Corinthians look at it and go, that's not amazing. But first he tells them again, here's why I'm engaging in fool's talk. He said, I repeat, let no one take me for a fool. He's making sure they know, look, I know this is fool's talk, but if you do, then receive me as you would a fool, so I may do a little boasting. In this self-confident boasting, I'm not talking as the Lord would, but as a fool. Since many are boasting in the way the world does, I will too. You gladly put up with fools since you're so wise. In fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you, exploits you, takes advantage of you, pushes himself forward, slaps you in the face. To my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. So he's using fool's talk to make his point that the Corinthians were so gullible that they were falling for folly. And he said, I'm not talking like the Lord would talk. I'm using their kind of talk to demonstrate how foolish it is. Verse 21 is dripping with irony. I'm too weak to bully you. And they've got to be thinking by now, as they're reading this or hearing it read in church, wait a minute, Paul did serve us. And those other guys, they were bullies. Actually, they were kind of jerks. Why are we so impressed with them? Well, I'll tell you why, Paul is saying, because they were cool and they were convincing, and you use the standards of the world to measure them by. And whatever standard of measurement we use, family, church, business, community, to define what's good, what's cool, what's to be aspired to, is exactly the kind of culture that will be produced. And when that standard looks like arrogance or self-promotion or any other kind of folly, that's the kind of culture that's produced. Another baseball deity, Mickey Mantle, also lived a really horrible personal life off the field. The difference between him and Ted was he came to Christ at the end of his life. And he said, as an older man, he said, you know, the personal stories that I told over and over to get laughs and to look impressive, he goes, they're not funny. They're really horrible. See, Christ had changed his mind. And now what he valued, what was impressive, what was funny, what was cool, it changed as well. Christ grew him up. And he was embarrassed by the immature way he'd live, move through life. So his belief set changed, his heart followed his values. In the next section, Paul, of course, responds to the opponent's claims to having impeccable Jewish ancestry and to them being superior servants of Christ as opposed to Paul. Now remember, he's comparing stat sheets to demonstrate how foolish this is. And so he said, if you want to compare stat sheets to decide who's a reliable messenger of God, my stats are pretty good. Look at verse 21. What anyone else dares to boast about, and he says, I'm speaking as a fool here, I also dare to boast about. Are they Hebrews? Me too. Israelites? Me too. Abraham's descendants? So am I. So Hebrew, Israelite, Abraham's descendants. You may be thinking that sounds redundant, and it is, but he's probably highlighting three different things. His own pedigree ethnically, then socially, then theologically. Bottom line, no one has better stats than Paul. Now, as to his servants to Christ, none of them compares. Verse 23, are they servants of Christ? He says it again. He's so compelled. I'm out of my mind to talk like this. I'm more. It's really hard for him to say this, but they need to hear it. And then here's the front page of his website. I've worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. Five times I've received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus ones, which often would kill you the first time you had that. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, bandits, my own countrymen, Gentiles, in the city, in the country, at sea, in danger from false brothers. I've labored and toiled and gone often without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst and have gone often without food. I've been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I don't feel weak? Who is led into sin and I don't inwardly burn? You got to believe this stuff to keep going after all that. And so Roman officials throughout the empire were expected to celebrate their own achievements. And when they finished their terms of office, they would carve in stone their list of accomplishments. And some of these monuments have survived. Caesar Augustus left his achievements in huge letters on monuments all over the empire. And if you were a veteran of the Roman military, like Augustus was, you would also list your campaigns fought, like your wounds, Purple Hearts, decorations received, were you in Desert Storm, were you in Iraqi Freedom, whatever. And these were also carved in stone. And this is all indicative of how the Corinthians had been trained to think, and it was what they'd come to believe was most valuable. Stats to prove what matters the most. Stats to prove I'm better, I'm important, I matter. Stats starved and cone. Who cares? What matters most at the end matters most now, and trust me, stats, even those carved in stone, will not matter at the end. But this was how they had been trained at the head and heart level to look at life. And remember, the oldest believers in Corinth were probably 4 or 5 year old believers, and so it was going to take time for the truth to retrain them. The reason their heads were so easily turned is because they hadn't yet grown up in their faith. And so they saw this celebrity worship all around them, and just like the modern church, they applied celebrity worship in the church. This is the kind of person they wanted their own apostle, Paul, to be. They wanted him to be cool like the super apostles. Instead, while someone else gets these really eloquent, nice-looking, cool, they get shabby-looking Paul, awkward-speaking Paul, blunt Paul. He even works with his own hands. But Paul's not trying to compete with the world's standards. He's actually mocking him here. His boast list doesn't have the right stuff. He gives the kind of things that's supposed to be he's supposed to be ashamed of, stuff that shows he's not chasing cool. He even missed the fact that he cares for them. You go, well, what's wrong with that? That's not cool. He said, who is weak and I don't feel weak? Who's led into sin and I don't inwardly burn? When I watch or read biographies of great people, it's most common to portray them as people who are beyond being touched by other people. They're rocks, they're islands, they're untouched by what others think of them. And yet, ironically, most often, they're very childish in how much what others think of them impacts their moods and behavior. Ted Williams, Ernest Hemingway, these are examples of men who are held up by culture as rugged individuals who don't care what anybody thinks, but if you look at their lives, their moods and behaviors were almost totally shaped by what they thought others thought of them. So fascinating. And they both held lifelong grudges against anybody who dared doubt their greatness. But Paul's not childish like that. He's connected at the heart to the people he loves. He's free from what others think of him in determining how he lives, but he writes unashamedly, I struggle when you struggle. What happens to you matters so much that it impacts my very soul. And this is demonstrating, again, kind of uncool openness in what seems to be weakness. Then finally, his crowning achievement is a direct slap in the face of one of his culture's greatest accomplishments. So for a Roman soldier, the greatest of all honors, like our Medal of Honor, was called the Corona Mirabilis, the wall crown. And in the siege of a city, ladders are put up to go over the wall. It was crazy dangerous, as you can imagine. You've seen the movies. You've seen what happened to the orcs when they were the first one up the ladder. You know, they got spears in their necks. And so in Rome, the first person up the wall on the ladder received the wall crown. It was like their Medal of Honor. And Paul knows this, as do all the Corinthians. And so they're going to understand that he's boasting here again about the wrong things when he writes this. Verse 30, if I must boast, I'll boast of all the things that show my weakness. What? The God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, who is to be forever praised, knows I'm not lying. Then he's going to tell a story that was early on in his missionary journeys. It was really kind of his first brush with persecution that we know of. He said, in Damascus, the governor under King Aretas had the city of the Damascenes guarded in order to arrest me. But I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall and slipped through their hands. So he's telling this story. And in this story, it's not like, yeah, I'm walking in there and I'm casting out demons. You know, people are just coming to Christ. That kind of stuff happened to him. But he tells this story where it's kind of the opposite of the wall crown. He's not the first one up the ladder. He's being lowered like Amazon boxes over the wall. A grown man. This is very humiliating. Hidden, hiding, running away for Jesus. That's the wall shame, not the wall crown. And he's telling him this. He's not trying to be cool. He's demonstrating the values of the kingdom are very different from those of the culture that swirled around him. And so he's going to continue talking this fool's talk in the next chapter, but let's stop there and finish with some application. First application, we have to continually pay attention to taking our thoughts captive to Christ. This is a big deal for Paul and for God and for us. This is where the battle for our lives begins, our core beliefs, our ideas. And if you don't like the war analogy, then this is where the seeds that become the fruit that we will eat out of are planted. We will eat from the kind of garden that we let grow in our minds. And we've been given by God great power and therefore great responsibility over what thoughts, ideas, beliefs we allow to dominate our minds and take root there. And Paul's determined that they get the truth right because everything follows from there. This is not to freak out over every theological nuance. It's not to go looking for heresy under every bush or in every blog. That's dumb. Don't do that. But it's to be generously and joyfully embracing the foundational truth of the gospel. Some say there is no true truth, or if there is, we can't know it. But everyone lives as if some things are true and some things are not, and they can know those things. Everyone is living out of their belief system, even those who say they have none. We're confident as believers that we can know truth because God has spoken. In His mercy, He's allowed us to know truth about Him. We can get it wrong, but we can get it right, and we want to get it right. And so we study God because He's allowed Himself to be studied. If He hadn't, we'd have no idea. He's allowed Himself to be studied through His Word. And we're to study like the lover studies his beloved in order to love. The truth of God is not something to fight over or kill for. It's something to live in. It's not something to be angry or combative about, but it is something to work hard at. Again, not merely to become someone who studies God, but to be one who better loves God, which brings us to the next point of application. We want to let the truth of the gospel nest in our heads so it will better shape our hearts. Ted Williams believed that if others would think of him as the greatest hitter, then it would satisfy his deepest heart's yearning. His dad was not a part of his life until he was signing his pro contract and his dad was there with his hand out. His mom was so busy saving the world as a missionary that she was losing her own two sons. And so Ted grew up with this hole in his heart baseball couldn't fill. And it made him angry and bitter and foolish when he achieved his life goal and the hole had gotten larger. And it's bound to happen when our controlling passion can't satisfy our heart's longing. Paul wanted the Corinthians to know the truth of God so they could live in a life-giving relationship with God. So look at how he ties head and heart together at the very beginning of this chapter. He said, I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. Cunning is the skill of using deceit to achieve your own ends. And Satan used deceit, twisting what God had said, to turn Eve's mind in order to capture her heart. He used the skill of deceit to achieve his goal, which was to turn her heart away from God. And how did he do that? He started with her mind, with her thinking. And so Paul wants the Corinthians to believe truth, not so they'll be really good theologians or win more arguments in Corinth, but so they'll live with sincere and pure devotion to Christ, loving, life-giving relationship with God. And if someone has accurate theological knowledge and they think that they're spiritually mature, they know so much about God and they can quote the theological data, but they're not getting better at loving people, then it's nonsense. They don't know truth about God. Absolutely don't. So, let's think about our thinking and think about our loving, what's in our hearts. Doubt your doubt. The gospel's true. If you doubt, I have read of people who have deconstructed their faith and walked away, and they felt like in their church where they grew up or in their families, whatever, that they had to hide their doubt. That's just not true here. And those of you who've grown up as students know, I've had lots of conversations with lots of you about your doubt, and I've never done anything but congratulate you for being open with it. I was at Super Summer with our students 2 weeks ago, and they were asking questions, open questions, great questions. So, we're not afraid of questions. We're not afraid of doubts. But doubt your doubt. The gospel is true, not just here in our church. It's true in the Middle East where the gospel originated. It's true in the global South and the global East where it's growing exponentially. It's truth here in church. It's truth in boardrooms and hospital rooms and bedrooms and classrooms and battlefields and graveyards. It's true at NASA. It's true in the Pentagon. It's true everywhere. You say, well, it doesn't seem true. It is. It's the very truth of God, the one true truth. So wrap your, let the truth nest in your mind, wrap your heart around the truth, so that over time, what God values more and more shapes what we value. That's what Paul was after. Because what shapes our values, shapes our behaviors, this becomes our life. Heads, hearts, habits become a life full of God. Let's pray together. This is your chance to just talk to God. I'll stop talking in just 1 minute. Think about, are you having doubts? And have you been faithful to doubt your doubts, to scrutinize them? What are the beliefs you're struggling with? Are you being honest with your friends about it? Is it really more of a heart issue, what you're wrapping your heart around? Talk to God. Let Him speak to you.